Okay, thanks a lot. So what I will try to do in this presentation is to persuade you that singularity resolution mechanisms might not be removed from observations. So it's something cosmologists should be interested in, and it's also something that people interested in fundamental physics should hope for, because you want to actually hope that things, that the physics of singularity resolution can be tested. So I'm going to present on the board. That's in part because I usually like to do that, but also in part to encourage questions. So this is the outline of the presentation. I will first try to argue that we shouldn't take inflationary cosmology for granted. I'll try to give a list of criticisms that should lead you open to the suggestion that cosmology of the very early universe did not involve inflation. So then, in the second part of the talk, I'll try to make a connection between what we heard of so far in the workshop on singularity resolution and how this might lead to new cosmological backgrounds. Then, the key issue in cosmology is structure formation. So the third part of the talk, I'll present a particular new background, which comes from string gas cosmology, and I'll talk about string gas cosmology and structure formation. And the references for this is this series of papers, which were written in collaboration with Ali Nayeri, Komun Wafa, and Subodh Patil. And a review is in this paper that just appeared this morning. So then there's another message that I'd like to try to get across very briefly at the end. This relates to a very different type of background, a type of background that you could have in the ekaryotic scenario, but maybe also in others. I'll try to show you that evolving bulk metric fluctuations through a cosmological bounce has results which look much more optimistic from the point of view of what authors of the ekaryotic scenario wanted compared to what was previously known. And the reference there is this paper, which is in collaboration with Thorsten Battefeld, and again, Subodh Patil, excellent graduate students of mine. Okay, so let me now first discuss why one should look beyond inflationary cosmology, my list of criticisms against scalar field-driven inflation. So before giving you the criticism, I obviously have to briefly review the setup. So a very brief review of inflation. So inflation is based on the idea that there's a timeline in cosmology starting with the Big Bang and involving a period in which the universe is expanding exponentially, or at least accelerating. For concreteness, I'll write down exponentially expanding. And then after this, you should have standard cosmology. So that's the idea. So now if you want to get this kind of period of exponential expansion in the context of general relativity as your theory of space-time, then you need a new form of matter, which you see very easily if you just take the Friedmann equation. Continuity equation. If you want exponential expansion, the energy density has to be constant. If the energy density is constant, you need pressure almost equal to minus energy density. And in general, since we all know how many scalar fields have been observed in nature, you postulate the existence of a scalar field phi. And given the scalar field phi with canonical energy momentum tensor, you can write down the expressions for the energy density and the pressure, and you get kinetic energy, which does not give inflation. Then you have tension, which does not give inflation either. But then, for scalar fields, you have the possibility of having potential energy, and potential energy can give you inflation.
Just to be fair to these inflation guys, though, I mean, new form of matter does mean different from matter and radiation, but in fact, some such new form of matter has been experimentally observed because the universe is accelerating now.
No, I disagree with that statement. We don't know that it's a new form of standard matter. It could be our ignorance of gravity. We do know.
Sort of rewriting general relativity, we have observational evidence that some new form of matter is out there, one or the other, anyway.
Yes, that's true. Also, we know that in particle physics models, one does introduce scalar fields very often, for good reasons. So, just none has been observed. Okay, so if you have scalar fields, many people like scalar fields, then you have the possibility of getting inflation, but potential energy has to dominate over kinetic energy. And this has to happen for a long period of time. And this gives rise to the famous slow roll conditions that you need for inflation. Okay, so the scenario that you have then is, I'll draw a series of sketches. You have a new scalar field with the potential, and you assume that the scalar field does not start where you would normally want it to start out, namely at the minimum. You start it out somewhere here. Then it starts to slowly roll down the potential. So as a function of time, the evolution of the scalar field phi, like this. Eventually, the scalar field starts to oscillate about its minimum once it reaches sufficiently small value. And this sufficiently small value is M Planck. And then you have to arrange your theory such that during this period of oscillation, the energy of the scalar field is transferred to ordinary matter. So if you follow the temperature of ordinary matter as a function of time, the temperature of ordinary matter may start out large. It exponentially decreases during inflation. Then in this process where ordinary matter is generated, it shoots up, then it decays again. So that's why this time is called reheating. Okay, so now, what does inflation achieve? So, successes. I won't write everything down, but it's important to keep that in mind. It solves the horizon problem, so it explains the isotropy of the microwave background. It creates a large universe from small initial conditions. It creates a large amount of entropy compared to Planck entropy. And it creates spatial flatness. So, nice overall features. But most importantly, it generates a structural formation mechanism. This is what I'll focus on now. So now I will draw the space-time diagram that you have for inflationary cosmology. Space and time. This is the time of reheating. So what I will plot now is two scales. The first scale is the Hubble radius. And the Hubble radius is important because on length scales smaller than the Hubble radius, matter dominates. On length scales larger than the Hubble radius, matter is frozen out, and gravity dominates. So if you want to create fluctuations using non-gravitational physics, you have to create them on sub-Hubble scales. So that's the meaning of the Hubble radius. It has nothing to do with the horizon, because the horizon in inflationary cosmology is exponentially larger than the Hubble radius. Okay. Now the second scale that's important is the physical wavelength associated with scales that we observe. And I'll just label this curve with K. And during inflation, wavelengths expand exponentially. This scale expands exponentially. So the success of inflation is that all scales that we observe today originate sub-Hubble in the very early universe, and therefore you can have a causal generation mechanism of fluctuations. What is this causal generation mechanism of fluctuations? Well, if you have lots of matter at the beginning of inflation, but you have a long period of inflation, all the matter that you have is redshifted. So you are left with the quantum matter vacuum. And so therefore the mechanism that operates here is quantum vacuum fluctuations. So I emphasize this space-time diagram, firstly, to point out the main success of inflation, and secondly, to make contact with the corresponding diagram that I will draw here. So this is my... Okay. Now, from this diagram, you can see that you will get a scale-invariant spectrum of fluctuations. If you look at mass fluctuations in a sphere of radius K inverse, at a time when these fluctuations exit the Hubble radius, then by time translation invariance of this phase, your result will be independent of scale. So there's a geometric origin of this scale invariance of the spectrum. And since inflation has to come to a close, the Hubble radius is not exactly constant, but it's slightly tilted like this, and that gives rise to a scale invariant spectrum with a slight red tilt in most models. In particular, the gravitational waves have a slight red tilt of the fluctuations because the amplitude of the gravitational waves is set by the Hubble constant. So, scale invariant spectrum, slight red tilt for most models for the cosmological perturbations, and in all models, a slight red tilt for the gravitational waves. Okay, these are the predictions which I will compare with the predictions of the alternative scenario.
So the red tilt means that this index n is slightly less than 1?
Yes.
So that's what's observed?
Yeah. Well, depending on, I would say, 0.95 plus or minus 0.05. Not really statistically different from 1 yet, but yeah, it's...
That means it hasn't.
Yeah. But the simplest inflationary models predict something like 0.96, but it's easy to get. Just in general, from many models, you predict a slight red tilt of the cosmological perturbations, not for all, but for all models with standard matter, you predict a red tilt for the spectrum of gravitational waves. Because the spectrum of gravitational waves is determined by H alone, whereas the amplitude of the spectrum of cosmological perturbations is not only determined by H. But it's...
But I'm making a more elementary point, which is that a one sigma effect is not an effect. If something is observed at the one sigma,
it's
been observed.
Sure. No, but just be careful what I said. There are two spectra here, and there are inflationary models which predict a blue spectrum for the cosmological perturbations, but not for the gravitational waves. And I'm making that point because I want you to remember this when I come to this. Okay. Now let me give you a very subjective list of what I see as problems of inflation. So first problem is the nature of this scalar field that gives rise to inflation. So first of all, you need a scalar field. If you have a scalar field, the slow roll conditions have to be satisfied. Even if those are satisfied, you need special initial conditions, or you don't need, this standard initial condition does not work. You have to have other initial conditions. And then you have to make sure that this scalar field couples correctly with ordinary matter. So the whole list of criteria, and I think probably most people would agree that there is not yet, in spite of more than 20 years of work, There's not yet a convincing model of scalar field driven inflation. The Méditerranée models, but not really a convincing model. Okay, so that's the first problem. Now, even if you satisfy all the conditions that I've mentioned so far, there's a problem of amplitude. This was a problem.
Listen, people talking about eternal inflation, they sound like, you know, once it starts, there's no problem with having it going on and on. Where will these?
That would address the initial condition, criticism. But to this, I would reply that in the context of a potential like this, eternal inflation is not on a solid mathematical footing. The usual treatments of eternal inflation, they violate the Bianchi identities. The equations of motion are not consistent with the Bianchi identities. So I do not consider eternal inflation in the context of such potentials as really something solid. Right. Because you have these quantum fluctuations which drive you up the potential, and the back reaction has not been included. And if you include the back reaction, you get effects which are bigger than the effects that drive you up the potential. But that would be a different seminar. I could give another seminar on that. But let's assume that you have a scalar field that has the right initial conditions that is slowly rolling. For example, a scalar field with this potential. Then the amplitude of the mass fluctuations is predicted to be about 100 times lambda to the 1/2. And you would like this to be 10 to the minus 5. So it's possible, but you have to tune this lambda to a very small value. So there's a hierarchy problem. That's the amplitude problem. And so this problem is not special to this potential, as was discussed by Alan Guth, Katie Fries and Fred Adams in a paper, I think, in about 1990. So, okay. So now, relevant to this meeting is the fact that if you couple scalar fields, scalar field matter to Einstein gravity, you don't avoid the initial singularity. Borde and Vilenkin, Borde is actually going to arrive this week, they were able to extend the Penrose-Hawking singularity theorems to apply to classical scalar field matter plus gravity. So there's a singularity. So therefore, the model cannot be complete. So now many people would say that we don't care because all effects are hidden by inflation. But I disagree with that, and this is a Transplanckian problem. And I want to elaborate on this. Because you see, there's another scale in the problem, namely the Planck length, or the string scale. And in models, in most toy models of inflation that have been proposed, the period of inflation lasts a long, long time. It lasts so long that all scales that we observe today start out at the initial time of inflation with a wavelength much smaller than a Planck length. So in doing the analysis of how fluctuations evolve, we are using classical general relativity and scalar field matter on length scales much, much smaller than a Planck length. So obviously we are doing an inconsistent calculation. Okay, so now you can ask, are the predictions going to be robust towards modifications which come from the new physics region? There's some kind of new physics that has. And Jérôme Martin and myself, we showed that the predictions are not robust at all. You can get very large corrections to the usual predictions of inflation. And the magnitude of these corrections is only constrained by demanding that the back reaction of these effects does not prevent inflation altogether. So you can get large, and by large I mean order one effects. But this is not, from the point of view of people at this meeting, this is not a problem, but this is actually a window of opportunity.
there some date time that you have to be beyond before these come back in?
Yes, so if you have an inflationary model where the number of e-foldings of inflation is less than 70, it has to be more than 50 to solve the problems. If it's less than 70, you are safe. If inflation lasts more than 70 e-foldings, you are subject to this.
For the present
scale.
So there's also a Trans-Planckian problem in principle with black hole operators.
Yes.
Right. But various work by Delaney, Ted Jacobson,
right,
people seem to indicate that that's actually not a problem and that things are fairly sensitive to that.
Right.
There's some intuitive way of understanding why Trans-Planckian problems don't cause problems with black hole evaporation, but do cause problems with inflationary fluctuations?
Actually, the latest paper by Bill Unruh on this subject shows that there is a possibility of effects even for black holes. I'm referring to a paper by Schutzhold and Unruh. So window of opportunity. I'm not saying that there are definitely going to be corrections.
But Robert, when you say that there could be orbital effects, are you talking about your work where the dispersion relation developed a low frequency, high wave vector region?
Yes, I'm referring to work where we replace the usual dispersion relation, the linear dispersion relation for fluctuations, by a dispersion relation, omega as a function of k, which has this form.
Where that dip down there is?
That dip is much larger than the present Hubble expansion rate, but smaller than the Hubble expansion rate during inflation.
Right. So it's important. That has to do with why there's something is a feature that's very profound at high wave vectors, so that the evolution of those modes out there was non-adiabatic during the early years.
Right.
And so something got excited, and then there are relics hanging around from that experience.
Right, and different modes spend a different amount of time in this phase where they are being excited, and therefore you get deviations from scaling invariance.
The number of e-foldings was even less than 70.
No, if it's less than 70, if it's between 50 and 70, then this problem does not concern the wavelengths that we observe today.
Okay, but it might be useful. I mean, it might still be observable in the distant future, or was it?
No, not. It would be observed in the distant future. Yeah, but that's...
Yeah.
I'm not interested in that. Too distant for me. Too distant for me.
What's the source of this dip?
No, this is just a toy model. I don't...
Oh,
so, it's a toy model designed to show that it's possible to have large effects. But you see, I'd like to move on because I'd like to go to discuss possibilities that you don't have inflation at all. So, now, in models of inflation, most scalar field driven models of inflation, the scale, energy scale at which inflation occurs is very high. It's about the scale of grand unification, which is quite close to the string scale, and it's quite close to the Planck scale. And we know that at the string scale and at the Planck scale, that any approach to quantum gravity, be it string theory, loop quantum gravity, other approaches, they will all predict that the Einstein action will break down. There'll be correction terms which become dominant. So, inapplicability of GR at these scales. And finally, the last problem, it's a cosmological constant problem. So,
all the problems, just the ones you want to address.
No, just the ones that I want to address. But please, free.
This observation recently made by Strzelecki and various others that might easily be repeated in this program. In what sense does a quantum fluctuation translate into a classical fluctuation?
I'll say something about this, actually. in terms of the fluctuations, it is reasonably well understood, this issue. Not the background, just for the cosmological perturbations. So anyway, we know that any quantum matter that's coupled to any quantum matter has vacuum energy, quantum vacuum energy. So I take my scalar field psi, it will have a quantum vacuum energy. And this quantum vacuum energy is large, even in models with supersymmetry, because supersymmetry is broken today. But this quantum vacuum energy does not gravitate. That's an observational fact, because we don't see the universe accelerating at this huge rate. So there's something that tells us that constant potential energy, vacuum energy, does not gravitate. So in inflation, we are using a scalar field with a different variable, but we are using exactly the part of the potential energy that looks like this. We are using the constant part of the potential energy to drive inflation. So I would claim that in the absence of knowing what solves the cosmological constant problem, we have no right to use the constant part of the potential energy to gravitate. That's the Achilles heel of inflation, because it's really, it's a basic mechanism of inflation.
That seems awfully radical, because after all, this vacuum energy is going to convert into ordinary matter, which does gravitate.
Yeah.
And so the Eke identity tells you if the produced matter is going to gravitate, this had to gravitate too. So you...
But maybe that's some subtraction. So the question is, what couples, what is the matter that actually couples to G mu nu?
But if one form of energy can convert to another,
yep,
then the identity tells you that anything that if one form does, the other form does as well.
But is it the difference that converts, or is it the absolute amount?
Whatever part, I mean, it just...
We got matter out at the end of inflation.
Yes.
There's got to be something before.
Right.
Gravitate.
Right.
Yeah, well, there's definitely something that gravitates, but maybe it's only the difference maybe it's just rho plus p that gravitates.
But I'm slightly confused. Why can't in the inflationary potential that the height, right, phi equals zero, just be the present cosmological constant or something like that?
No, but I'm saying that if you take fields, then there's a huge vacuum energy. It's given by the supersymmetry breaking scale to the fourth power. And that does not gravitate. So there's something that tells us that...
That could be cancelled, right?
Yeah.
That could be cancelled.
Right, so we have to show that this cancellation does not prevent inflation.
Yeah, presumably...
Now, you see, I could...
There is a cancellation mechanism, then certainly that does not prevent inflation.
So anyway, so I can present possible mechanisms to solve a cosmological constant problem which do not prevent inflation. But I think it's really the basic driving force of inflation is tied to this deep problem. One should keep that in mind.
So could I rephrase it? If somebody happened to solve a cosmological constant problem, in your view, they might very well rule out inflation.
Yes, but they also might confirm that it works. It depends on which... Let me be more specific. If the cosmological constant problem is solved by infrared effects, for example, by the back reaction of cosmological perturbations, then we can show that this will not prevent inflation. So hopefully I've give you some reasons to... That you should consider looking at scenarios which are different from which do not involve inflation. Okay. So now let me turn to things that we've heard last week. So I will assume for concreteness, just in order to draw diagrams nicely, I will assume that space is compact. Okay, so what did we hear from Joe? We heard that one approach to singularity resolution is through the ADS-CFT correspondence. He was referring to the work of Das et al. And to others, in which the scenario that emerges is so time direction, space, supergravity description is valid here. Here it's not valid. Here it has to be replaced by a different.
I wasn't referring to this.
Steve. You made so many comments in the talk. I thought you gave the talk.
I'm sorry.
So, okay. Now, actually, we also heard. About this from Abe, loop quantum cosmology, you again get a picture like this. A bounce in cosmology where here it's quantum effects that become dominant. Again, the classical supergravity description breaks down. And the pre-Big Bang scenario falls into this category as well. Except that the pre-Bang scenario doesn't resolve a singularity yet. So this is a possibility. And option one, something we'll hear about this week. Now I'm again giving someone else's talk. This goes under the name tachyon condensation. That you have a late phase which can be described by gravity, supergravity. And then there's an early phase in which tachyons condense, they cap off space. It's a bubble of nothing. Okay. And another possibility, which I don't think we'll hear about, is a situation where extra dimensions, where the extra dimensions predicted by string theory are really important, where in particular one of these extra dimensions is bouncing, and a space diagram can now be drawn this way. So here I have again time, and this diagram, this distance here, d, is a radius of the fifth dimension. And the radius of the fifth dimension, that's a function of time. So I'm referring to the ekparotic scenario. And yes, that's, so let me add here. So again, this phase cannot be described as supergravity. This phase cannot be described as supergravity. This phase cannot be described as supergravity, and we don't know how to realize it yet. And there's a variation of this, which I would call heterotic brain gas, where you have again a setup that the fifth dimension, that the dynamics of other dimensions is important. But here, what happens is, as a function of time, you start out Planck scale, all dimensions expand, then the extra dimensions contract, and they go through a non-singular bounce and stabilize. So let me give a reference for this. It's work with another student of mine, Natalia Schumacher, 605-11-299.
It stabilizes at a string scale?
String scale. Through string gas effect. So again, this region cannot be understood by supergravity. Okay, so
in scenario one, what happens to all the shear and inhomogeneity of the collapsing phase? Why does it disappear?
I don't know. But that's a very good question. The point that I want to make is that in all of common to all of these approaches is that there's something about the early universe. Here it's about this phase in which the radius is smallest, where the effect of supergravity action cannot be trusted.
In the original Hadley-Hawking thing, it was actually semi-classical all the way, right?
Yep. I mean, that's like starting it off here with the...
That possibility.
Yep. Yep. So, let me add this here. Okay. So, our intuition that comes from Einstein gravity cannot be trusted in this region, in this region, in this region, and in this region here. Okay. Now, another point I want to make is that in this scenario, and in this scenario, the universe starts out big, not small. So in this context, the horizon flatness and entropy and size problems are not relevant. Because if the universe starts out at low energy scales, the typical size is large, the typical entropy is large, so on. So some of the key problems which inflation solves, those are problems only if you start out small and have to become large. You see, the reason I'm making this point is that in this mechanism that I'll get to next, we do not have a solution of the size and flatness problems, but we have to invoke something that has a bounce or something else. Okay.
I'm sorry, when you say it starts out large, but eventually they collapse?
Yes, but what you have... So when the energy density becomes string scale, the universe is large in size. So, for example, you want to create the universe today with the present energy density, then you typically start out with a large universe. And then when you collapse to the Planck density, you would get a universe which is much more than Planck's size. But that's not central to what I will say, so allow me to go on, unless you have strong objections.
Well, I think there's a puzzle to that.
Is it our own history?
Right.
Yeah. Regardless of what happened before, it's time.
Yeah. Okay, one last comment is that we should expect that key new effects will enter in describing this early stage, this dense stage of the universe. Extra dimensions, if you start with string theory, then you'd expect string degrees of freedom, stringy symmetries to be relevant. If you start from quantum gravity, then you'd expect quantum effects to be relevant. So again, you'd in the applicability of GR intuition. That's what I'd like to highlight. So, let me now turn to a specific model. And I want to emphasize that this is a toy model. So, string gas cosmology and structure formation. So, first of all, the guiding principle. So So the guiding principle is that we want to use new degrees of freedom and symmetries. We do not know non-perturbative string theory, so we will be trying to implement these new degrees of freedom and symmetries in the context of a toy model. So let's look at the degrees of freedom that you have in string theory. So if you have, and again, I will assume that space is compact. It's a torus of radius r. And string scale I'll set to be r equals 1. So for a string can have momentum about the torus. It can wind about the torus. And a string has oscillatory modes. It's not just a point particle. These winding modes and oscillatory modes are new to string theory. Now, the energy of the momentum modes is quantized in units of 1 over r. The energy of the winding modes is quantized in units of r. And the energy of oscillatory modes is independent of r. Okay. Now, the oscillatory modes, they lead to a maximal temperature. If you take a gas of closed strings, then you cannot have a temperature larger than the Hagedorn temperature. Now, the winding modes, together with the momentum modes, leads you to a new symmetry, which is T-duality. If you take R, you replace it by 1 over R in string units, and at the same time, you replace the momentum and winding mode quantum numbers, then the spectrum of mass states of the string is unchanged. And this symmetry is preserved by interactions, by perturbative interactions, and now I'm referring to you, Joe. If you postulate that this is a symmetry of non-perturbative string theory, then you get D-brains. So let's assume that this is a good symmetry.
The torus is nine-dimensional.
Yes. Okay. So that's the guiding principle. So next we can ask, can we get singularity resolution? Already based on what I told you. So it looks encouraging. So if you take a box of strings with radius r, and you slowly decrease r, then the temperature never blows up. In fact, as a function of log r, it has this bell-shaped curve. I'm using the symmetry. T of r is equal to T 1 over r. So you can take this mathematical background space, you can let the radius go to the singular point, but there's no temperature singularity. So, now if there's some dynamics that tells me how r depends on time, then you get the following possibilities. So if the dynamics tells me that as I go back in time, r will come to rest here at this point, then I'll get this temperature-time evolution, which looks like in George Ellis's Emergent Universe.
Robert, T-duality alone doesn't resolve singularities because the dilaton blows up.
I'll get to that. That's why there's a question mark here. See, I didn't talk about the dilaton yet, because I didn't tell you what the background is. That's where the... If I want to make this precise, I have to tell you what the background is, and that's when this problem that you mentioned comes about. But so the dynamics might also tell you that R just decreases without bounds. In that case, you'd get this. So what I want to indicate here is that just from this temperature time curve, you should seriously think about the possibility that you might get bouncing scenarios. Bouncing in the sense of the temperature time curve, or emergent. Okay. But now we have to look at the problem a little bit more carefully. Now we have to specify the dynamics. So, equations of motion. Okay, so what we will do is we will have to pick a classical background. That's already bad from a fundamental level, because we would actually like to see how the background comes into the game. But we do not know non-perturbative string theory, so we will take a classical background coupled to string gas matter. And this classical background ought to be consistent with the basic symmetries, so it cannot be Einstein gravity, it has to be dilaton gravity. And then I will argue later on that it has to be something even different. Okay. So let's take this background, the background action. So phi is a dilaton. R is a Ricci scalar, determined as a metric. Now, I don't specify the number of dimensions here, because I'm going to... Now, in what follows, in a couple of minutes, I'll be restricting myself to the case where six of the spatial dimensions are confined to the string scale, and I will only be following the dynamics of the others. First, I'll be general. So, if I take this background action, I add to that the matter action, which just is the hydrodynamical action of a string gas, and if I look for cosmological solutions, so if I take the metric to be described by a scale factor, A of T, if I introduce the logarithm of a scale factor, and if I introduce a rescaled dilaton, n is the number of spatial dimensions, then the equations of motion become very simple. I have three equations of motion, the dilaton equation plus the two usual Friedman-Robertson-Walker equations. And they take the form n lambda dot square plus phi dot square equals e to the phi e, energy of the string gas, lambda double dot, minus phi dot lambda dot equals 1/2 e to the phi p, pressure of the string gas. These are the analogs of the Friedman equations, and the third equation is the dilaton equation of motion. And actually, it's quite likely that there should be a lambda dot square here. So these are the three equations of motion. And I want to focus on this equation. So from this equation, you see that negative pressure prevents lambda from growing. Positive pressure prevents lambda from decreasing. So therefore, if you have a string gas which contains both winding modes and momentum modes, winding modes have negative pressure, momentum modes have positive pressure, then this equation corresponds to the dynamics in a potential with a fixed point, and the fixed point corresponds to the string scale. So this is the mechanism that is going to keep all of the six extra spatial dimensions compact. So that's moduli stabilization in string gas cosmology. If you work out the details, it works only in heterotic string theory. If you want also to fix the dilaton at the same time. So this is important. So from now on, so these equations I apply first in 9 spatial dimensions. Then I look at this set of equations, I find that all radii are confined to the string scale. If you keep winding modes present, you cannot eliminate winding modes in more than 3 spatial dimensions. So it's only in 3 dimensions that the winding modes can annihilate. Now we will pick the 3 spatial dimensions which start out with the smallest number of winding modes, and we will follow their dynamics.
So are you including only strings or also brains and fire?
Only strings, because brains fall out of equilibrium earlier, and it's the strings that determine the late time dynamics. So strictly speaking, I'm only considering strings.
But the brains, they wouldn't affect stabilization or whether these dimensions can grow. They fall out of equilibrium.
They also have it's actually the duality that ensures that you have the fixed point. But in terms of the annihilation, brains can, if I start out with democratic initial conditions, same number of no net quantum numbers, then all high-dimensional brains will annihilate. And the last things that will fall out of thermal equilibrium are the strings. But at the level of the equations that I present, only strings are present.
Why do you say this mechanism only for the hedonic string?
Okay, if you fix the dilaton, actually, can we talk about that privately? It has to do with... I should talk about that now. So in Einstein gravity, you know that negative pressure doesn't prevent expansion. So what has to happen is that these degrees of freedom, which contain both momentum and winding numbers, they have to have zero energy at the self-dual radius. If they have finite energy at the self-dual radius, they will act like a cosmological constant and cause all three dimensions to expand. Now, the key modes which have both momentum and winding, which are present in the bosonic string, they are factored out in type 2 using by the GSO projection. They're not there. In the heterotic, they are there. They survive. So that's why for fixed dilaton, the radion stabilization mechanism that we've shown only works for heterotic.
Want to apply these equations all the way to the Strindberg scale?
Yes, we are applying it to the Strindberg scale, and that's where you should question the separation between classical background and string gas matter.
So, it's one of the solutions that you can keep at most 3 dimensions large.
Right.
There's no natural mechanism which says that this will happen. It could be that there are only 2 dimensions which are not, no dimensions.
No, because the winding, if you start in the expanding branch, then you will have annihilations in 3 dimensions. The 3 dimensions might not start out isotropic, but there's a natural isotropization mechanism in the very early stages.
There are no solutions with just 2 dimensions.
That would be very, very fine-tuned. Then you'd have to make sure that 2 dimensions start expanding while the dilaton is still reasonably large, and then And then the dilaton suddenly becomes so small that in the third dimension they cannot annihilate.
But would it also happen that no dimension is fine?
Yes. If the dilaton starts out very, very small, then there are no annihilations. So the process that has to happen is the following. So if this is the torus, one dimension of the torus, you have to start with two winding modes, and these have to produce. This is a process that has to happen. And this vertex here, its value depends on the dilaton.
When you use the word start with, do you mean t equals 0 or t equals minus infinity? Is this a true initial?
It is t equals 0, and then I'll take the equations forward and backwards in time.
Can you expand on the comments about brains? I'm not sure why they're negligible.
No, early on they will not be negligible. But the point is that if you start, again, with no net brain winding number, equal number of brains winding one way and winding the other, then the brains will annihilate very rapidly. And so therefore leaving you with strings that dominate the dynamics at later times. So this is something which... So see, it's usually, in cosmology, that it's the mass of modes that fall out of equilibrium first. We are working at weak coupling, where the brains are heavier than the strings. So therefore the brains, if present initially, and if we have no net quantum numbers, they will fall out of equilibrium, they'll annihilate, self-annihilate. And then the strings will determine the later time dynamics. Okay. So, if we start out at t equals 0 with a gas of winding and momentum strings in equilibrium at close to the Hagedorn temperature, the maximal temperature, then we will have pressure equals 0. And lambda will be constant. This process will occur, and this process will generate positive pressure. It will generate the radiation phase. So if we follow the scale factor as a function of time, we will have static, then expanding. I will call this time T sub R, in analogy with reheating.
The value of the constant lambda of the A equals 0 is something that you can just choose.
Generically, it would be the string scale. And with tuning, you can make it larger. Okay. So this is the Hagedorn phase. And this is the radiation phase of standard Big Bang cosmology. And we have a smooth transition, and this is the process which generates this transition. Okay, so now we have to look at this third equation. And that's a problem. Because in the radiation phase, the dilaton is constant. If you look at the equation of motion for the dilaton, for a radiative equation of state, there's no driving force for the dilaton, and even if the dilaton starts out moving, it comes to rest by Hubble friction. However, in this phase, the dilaton is decreasing if you go forwards in time. So, what is happening? T sub R, dilaton, value 1. The dilaton starts out small. How small, I will tell you, because I'll determine it from observations. It is increasing. And there'll be a time Tc where the dilaton becomes, oops, zero. When the dilaton becomes greater than zero, the whole framework breaks down because we are now strongly coupled string theory. We need a new description, which we don't have.
At that point, are all, it's a Tc is before Tr.
Yeah, before Tr. Okay.
Over what volume do you need to have it on phase?
1 millimeter. And that is obtained. that is obtained by taking R Hubble radius back to grand unification scale using standard cosmology. R Hubble radius corresponds to 1 millimeter, which is very large compared to Planck scale.
So, I mean, by using just lambda, you've essentially, by fiat, zeroed out all the gravitational degrees of freedom.
I'll be including the perturbative ones. The next.
Okay, but in a gravitational collapse process,
yes.
They're generally big. So is this sort of an unrealistic toy model in the sense that what's been left out is very important, or is there some mechanism you have in mind that gets rid of these gravitational?
No, I. After your talk, I realize that this is a very good question, and I don't have the answer to that. So let's take this to be So it's a cosmological solution which we are looking for. And we might be looking for the wrong type of solutions if cosmological solutions are irrelevant. So I take that point.
What's your view on the superchange?
No, I'm not connecting to the... the way that I'm a cosmologist, and I will try to get the structure formation mechanism.
Sorry?
How this... You want me now to give you a specific string theory, which then...
Well, you're making a lot of reference to the string techniques, so I was just...
Well, because I'm using...
A supersymmetric string that you're going to...
Well, eventually I'll be using the string theory which seems to work best is heterotic string theory. That's because of radion stabilization. But, you know, the direction I'm heading is... to present you this new structure formation scenario. And I'm almost there. Okay. So now I have to add a big assumption. I will assume that phi is constant in this strongly coupled Hagedorn phase. Now, coming from the point of view of string theory, it's really a big assumption. I can present you with a completely different background where this assumption is automatically realized. But that other background has no string theory connection. Here I'm talking about work with Biswas, Mazumdar, and Warren Siegel, which just appeared. Okay, so now I have my background. The new background. At this point, I was working the string frame, but now I'm going to work in the Einstein frame. Static, expanding. Space-time diagram. And I'll compare that to inflation. So I remind you of what I had in inflation. Hubble radius. The Hubble radius. Universe is static, so the Hubble radius is infinite. This is inflation. This is string gas cosmology. And now a fixed co-moving scale, the same, because it's both times the radiation phase. The universe is expanding exponentially. The universe is static. Okay. So, fluctuations start out on sub-Hubble scales. Fluctuations start out on sub-Hubble scales. Therefore, a causal generation mechanism for fluctuations is possible here and here. Fluctuations evolve on super-Hubble scales. They evolve on super-Hubble scales. Now comes a very important comment for cosmologists. It's a fact that perturbations evolve on super-Hubble scales. That's responsible for the squeezing of the fluctuation modes, which gives you the acoustic oscillations which have been observed in the microwave background. You have that in inflation. You have that in this scenario too. So if you can generate a scale invariant spectrum here, then you have exactly the same predictions for observations as the predictions that you have in inflation. Unlike in topological defect models where you have no squeezing of fluctuations on super-Hubble scales. So even though it's strings that are responsible for this new structural formation mechanism, this stringy mechanism is very different from cosmic strings. Okay. Now, what is the mechanism? In the case of inflation, we had a quantum vacuum. So it was quantum vacuum fluctuations. The universe is expanding exponentially. All classical junk is redshifted. Here, the universe is static. The classical junk is not redshifted. The classical junk is dominant. The classical junk is strings. It is in thermal equilibrium. So, string thermodynamic fluctuations. Okay. So now I will show you how a scale invariant spectrum of cosmological perturbations emerges. You mean this shape here? It will matter if we want to calculate the magnitude of the spectral tilt.
But what determines it?
The process of winding mode annihilation. Oh, sorry. Yeah, let's leave it.
So, for you, it's just a line, that curve that goes out to x equals infinity.
Yeah. So, as this curve approaches the horizontal line, it turns out that the spectral tilt goes to zero. But let me show you how. It is TC. Because I'm calculating cosmological fluctuations in the Einstein frame, because it's in the Einstein frame that the usual perturbation equations are written down.
So everything below the horizontal axis depends on your assumption.
Yep, that's important.
Just to follow up, there's still a TR afterward, and that's going to produce some kink in your...
Yeah, but it's not important. It has no effect. Nope. Because scales are outside of the Hubble radius, and this kink will not generate adiabatic perturbations on super-Hubble scales. Okay, so metric fluctuations. So we have a three-step procedure. Since on sub-Hubble scales matter dominates, we focus on matter. So we fix our wavelength, we follow matter perturbations, until they exit the Hubble radius. This is K, Ti of K. At that point, we use the Einstein constraint equations. T to determine the metric fluctuations. And then we evolve the metric fluctuations for t greater than ti of k, like one does in inflation and cosmology. So the standard theory here. So that's the procedure. So you fix your scale. Ti of k is a time when that scale exits the Hubble radius. Okay. Now, the metric, in the presence of cosmological perturbations and gravitational waves, takes this form. Eta is conformal time. So these are the cosmological perturbations. These are the gravitational waves. So if we use this metric, we evaluate the Einstein constraint equations, then we get the following equations that determine the metric perturbations and the gravitational waves in terms of the matter fluctuations. We get a relativistic Poisson equation, which says that it's the energy density fluctuations which determine the cosmological perturbations and the amplitude of the gravitational waves is determined by the off-diagonal stress perturbations. So we will calculate these quantities in this early phase. At Hubble radius cross, and we use these equations to compute phi and h, and then we have the answer. So if you allow me to go 5 minutes more, I can actually do the calculation of the spectrum right here on the board in one kind of board. Is that okay?
5 minutes?
5 minutes, yes. Okay, so the power spectrum is defined as k cubed over 2 pi square. I even will include the factors of pi. That's the definition of the power spectrum, Fourier space. I use this equation to write it in terms of the energy density fluctuations. I get 8 g square k to minus 1 delta rho of k square. Now I go to position space. I replace density fluctuations by mass fluctuations. Or it's just the radius corresponding to k. So now I use thermodynamics, which tells me that the mass fluctuations are given by the specific heat. So this is a general formula. So now I do string thermodynamics, STD, string thermodynamics. If I use compact space, the result is that the specific heat is R square divided by string length cubed temperature, 1 divided by 1 minus temperature over Hagedorn temperature, where this temperature is to be evaluated at this time. That's close to the Hagedorn temperature. So, holographic scaling of specific heat on radius. This R cancels the K. Gives you a scaling down spectrum. So, the result is that the power spectrum, d5k, is approximately equal to L Planck over L string to the fourth times 1 divided by 1 minus T over TH. This is a result. And it took me less than 5 minutes. So, scaling variant. Slight red tilt, because smaller length scale means temperature at exit is slightly smaller. The magnitude of the red tilt vanishes if the curve is horizontal. And you get an amplitude. And if you go to the textbook by Green, Schwartz, and Witten on string theory, you take their favorite value for the string length versus the Planck length, you get the right amplitude. No amplitude problem. Now, what I don't have time to do is to give you the power spectrum of gravitational waves. It's a calculation of this length, and the result for the power spectrum of gravitational waves, LT over LS to the fourth, the deeper you are in the Hagedorn phase, the smaller the pressure, and therefore you get the blue tilt. Scale invariant with the blue tilt, and that's a specific prediction of the scenario with which it could be distinguished from inflation. Okay, so unfortunately I did not have time to discuss how perturbations might go through an ekpyrotic bounce, but the bottom line is I think that one should keep an open mind to the possibility that inflation is not part of the cosmology of the Aryan universe. And this, if not anything else, it's at least a toy model to show that you can get a scale invariant spectrum of adiabatic fluctuations with the nice properties that give you the acoustic oscillations without inflation. So, thanks.
So, even though you work in the ice and plane, they still adjust in the field. So, what happens to this and this?
So, the dilaton is evolving between time tc and time tr. And you can take into account the effects of the dilaton fluctuations on the metric perturbations. And that's no problem, doesn't change the result.
Is that negligible, or the effects are negligible?
Yes, they're negligible on large scales. Ted?
What about the amplitude of the gravitational waves?
Right, so you see it's given by the same factor. So the ratio of tensor to scalar modes is 1 minus T over TH square.
Right,
so it depends on how close the temperature is to the Hagedorn temperature in the Hagedorn phase.
So what's your expectation that factor is of order unity?
No, it's smaller. Because T is quite close to T sub H. But I can't make it more concrete. So see, the temperature in these formulas is evaluated when the scales exit, which is deep, which is in the Hagedorn phase.
But that's different times if there's any horizontal, there's any tilt in that line.
Right. So you will see, you will predict a running of the spectrum as well.
So can you commit to some... is it consistent, basically, is really what I'm getting at.
Yes, it's definitely consistent.
So far, it sounds like they're much stronger than they are in the standard inflationary.
That's what I thought initially when I saw these formulas. But then when I thought about how close the temperature probably is to the Hagedorn temperature, you see that that's actually not the case. The temperature is very close. It's not just half the Hagedorn temperature. See, the temperature is essentially almost equal to the Hagedorn temperature here.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, unfortunately, I cannot, since I do not know the exact temperature curve here, I cannot really give you an exact number for the spectral tilt, and I also can't give you a number for the tensor to the scalar ratio, but they're all related. It's just the same ignorance factor that determines everything.
I'll push you later about it.
But it's a definite prediction, right?
Yeah.
If anyone ever measures a tilt, then you have a prediction for the ratio of gravitational perturbations.
Correct.
And perturbations.
Correct.
And both of those can, in principle, be measured.
Yep.
So it's a definite prediction,
yep,
of at least the relation,
right,
between these two measurable quantities.
Right. And that's, and then there's the other prediction that the spectrum of gravitational waves has an opposite tilt of the same magnitude.
Okay. So two definite predictions.
Two definite predictions. Yeah.
Am I correct that some assumption of thermal equilibrium here?
Yes.
Was that put in, or did it come out?
No, that was put in. Because I started at time t equals zero and I evolved forwards, and then I can also evolve backwards. Let me just tell you, there's another possibility. So this string gas scenario can be implemented in a theory of high derivative gravity, which was constructed by Biswas, Mazumdar, and Siegel to avoid ghosts and to create an asymptotically free theory. So it's a high derivative gravity action constructed with kinetic corrections. So there's the action involves integral of f of r, where f of r is something like is r plus an infinite sum coefficients r box r. This has a property that it's asymptotically free. It gives bouncing solutions, and there are no light mass gravitational degrees of freedom. So in this framework, you can start with an unperturbed contracting universe. So if you couple this to stringy matter, it is in thermal equilibrium at early times, early in the contracting phase, then you have thermal equilibrium throughout.
Okay. My other question is, what happens if you run it back at t equals minus infinity? You get it. Is it just reflections?
You have a bounce.
Right.
Run all the way back to the beginning.
So the picture is the universe collapsed and then bounced.
Now you go back to the string gas.
Yeah.
No, it's not, because you see the problem is that we don't have the strongly coupled Hagedorn phase under control. So we stick this in, and then and the problem is that we have to stick in a strongly coupled Hagedorn phase of 1 millimeter size, not string size. Where does this 1 millimeter come from? This is an important objection. We could get that by invoking a heterotic brain gas as a precursor phase. That was the scenario 4, which I had when I listed the different scenarios.
Thank you.
The last question. How do you know the strongly coupled Hagedorn phase gives you a negative slope to the line there, positive slope?
Well, again, this is time here. And this is H. So this, it can't go up. What do you mean, slope like this as opposed to? I mean, I know, if I, with my assumption that phi is equal to constant, I know that in this phase, the Einstein frame scale factor is static. So that means Hubble radius is infinite.
I think that's just showing that how the expansion rate is going from zero to whatever it is at the beginning.
That's right. This automatically produces this.
Okay, let's thank Robert again.